So last week we kicked off our latest series called One. Pastor Justin kind of gave us some context for the Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. So we're going to continue that this week, and we're going to be talking about foolishness. Yeah. All right, so that's kind of where Justin was alluding to. He thinks maybe he might fit that kind of category, so maybe some of you do as well. Speaking of foolishness, a little while ago now, my sister and I, we travelled to the Mornington Peninsula. We were going to my cousin Jackie's hen's night. And so she had hired or booked a house down by the beach, and she'd invited some friends and family to come along and help her to celebrate. So my sister and I, we punched the address into maps and we took off. And when we got there, the numbers on the houses weren't very clear. But there was a house right where maps told us our destination was that had big glass windows facing the road. And so inside the house, we could see that there was a bunch of women. There were pink balloons. Even I could see someone with a pink boa on. So we're like, cool. So we drove into the driveway. And my first thought was, well, my cousin Jackie has some really well-off friends. Because I think we parked next to like a Mercedes. I think there was a BMW and an Audi in the driveway. So we knocked on the door and no one answered, which was fair enough because there was music going on upstairs. So we let ourselves in and we... You can see where this is going. We actually went through every bedroom trying to figure out where we might stay, which ones hadn't been taken yet. And then we made our way upstairs into the kitchen and we're like, hey, we're here, let's get the party started or something like that. And they're like, yeah, how are ya? And my sister starts talking to them about how like long the trip was and how it was a little bit hard to find the house, but we eventually got here, a nice house, and they're talking like, yeah, like it's this many bedroom and it backs onto the beach, cool. And I'm standing there thinking, as they're having this perfectly normal conversation, going, something's not right here. And then my sister asks them, has Mum and Callie arrived yet? Which Callie's my other sister. And they're like, no, this is it, this is us. And then I'm looking at the lady in the pink boa going, why is she dressed like the hen? And where is my cousin Jackie? And so I said, so where's Jackie? And literally they're like, right here, pointing to the woman in the pink boa. And I'm like, is this Jackie's hen's night? And they're like, yeah, it is. And so my sister and I must have stood there for long enough with faces of total confusion. They're like, are you in the right place? And my face is getting brighter and brighter red as it dawns on me we have literally just let ourselves into the wrong house, went through all of their bedrooms, up their stairs, and announced ourselves at the wrong party. So we figured out they thought we were their entertainment. I got no idea what they think we were going to do. And we thought they were their guests. So anyway... we let ourselves back out the front door and my sister calls up, do you want us to lock the front door? And like, no, just leave it. I'm like, okay. So we backed out the driveway into the next driveway, knocked on the door and just did not go in until someone familiar answered. Safe to say, I walked away from that experience feeling pretty embarrassed and just a little bit foolish. And we've all got those stories, haven't we? Stories of feeling like fools. Maybe some more than others. Maybe you haven't let yourself into the wrong house. But come on, we've all felt pretty foolish before. And some stories are funny, and we're happy to share them. And others are not funny. Stories of like embarrassment and stupidity and foolishness are some stories we will never share, or maybe just with people closest to us, because they're the ones that possibly are full of really deep regret and shame. Maybe you have some of those as well. No one likes to feel like a fool or to be made a fool of. We hate the feeling of being fooled or treated like a fool. Playing the fool is okay, but being played for a fool is not okay. In fact, being found a fool or looking like a fool can actually stop us from trying or saying or believing or doing something. How many things have you not attempted for fear that you would look like a fool? How many things have you thankfully avoided knowing you would look like a fool? I was scrolling through my Facebook feed a little while ago and I saw a meme which I think presented just a shift in conversation now. I think presented the most effective argument against climate change. So no, this is not a message about climate change, so don't come up to me after the sermon and want to talk to me about it, because I won't want to talk. I am not saying that this is a good or bad statement. I am not saying it's a true or false statement. I'm just saying I think it is one of the most effective arguments against climate change. It reads, you'll have it on your screen, "What historians will definitely wonder about in future centuries is how a deeply flawed logic, obscured by shrewd and unrelenting propaganda, actually enabled a coalition of powerful special interests to convince nearly everyone in the world that CO2 from human industry was a dangerous, planet-destroying toxin. It will be remembered as the greatest mass delusion in the history of the world that CO2, the life of plants, was considered for a time to be a deadly poison." So I think it's effective because, seriously, who wants to be that generation that got it wrong, that was the generation of fools? Like, no one wants to be remembered ever for being the idiot, the dimwit, the simpleton. No one wants to be duped or stooged or suckered. No one wants to be the laughing stock or to be called deluded. The thought of change, or if you're looking to stop people from making change, stop them from believing something or trying something new, whether good or bad, tell them that they're going to end up looking like fools. It's incredibly powerful. The thought of looking stupid can stop us in our tracks, and sometimes that's wise, and sometimes it's foolish. The truth is, no one sets out to achieve something extraordinary, to try something new, or to believe something strange, hoping they'll end up looking stupid. But there are people who are willing to look stupid in order to believe something strange, try something new, or achieve something extraordinary. Take, for example, these ideas that people originally thought were foolish but turned out to be incredibly useful and successful. In 1879, one leading scientific mind called Thomas Edison's light bulb, a conspicuous failure. A year earlier, a British Parliament committee declared that the light bulb was good enough for our transatlantic friends, but unworthy of the attention of scientific or practical men. They thought the light bulb was ridiculous, and clearly they got it wrong. Bicycles were once seen as a passing fad enjoyed by people of bold and scandalous reputation. And in 1906, the New York Sun declared the fad dead and over. Automobiles were once considered so impractical that in 1902, the New York Times predicted the collapse of the entire industry and the foolishness of anyone who would invest into these inventions. Talking movies were declared box office gimmicks by leading artists of the day, who predicted that the noise of actors and actresses talking in films would simply drive audiences from the theatres. There is example after example of ideas, inventions, schools of thought, and discoveries that people initially thought foolish that turned out to be incredibly successful. And vice versa, there were people who first thought things to be something to be wise and revolutionary, but were soon found to be complete nonsense. So what does any of this have to do with today's passage that we're looking at? Some, in fact many, since the time of Jesus right through to today, have believed the gospel of Jesus to be incredibly foolish. At best, a useless invention fabricated by a group of first century religious radicals. At worst, a deeply flawed logic obscured by shrewd and unrelenting propaganda, driven by powerful special interest groups that is ultimately harmful to mankind. People throughout the ages have heard the message of the cross and have looked at the lives of those who live it and conclude it to be nonsense and a stumbling block to achieving something better, both for individuals and for entire societies. So is the message of the cross foolishness, or is it wisdom? Is it a stumbling block, or is it salvation? And Paul, in his first letter to the Corinthian church, would say yes and yes. Going from verse 18, we read, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. For it's written, 'I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate.' Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." Yes, it is foolishness to many. And yes, it is wisdom. It is a stumbling block to those who don't believe, but it is salvation to those of us who do. And it shouldn't really surprise us that people think what we believe is strange. Like, not just because Jesus warned us that they would, but consider what it is that we believe. We believe that there is a divine being that we can't see who is three in one. This divine being came to earth in flesh. He was born of a virgin. He died, and then 3 days after being in the grave, he rose to life again. He is king of a kingdom of which we are citizens. Humankind needs saving because of something that happened a very, very long time ago. People today think this stuff is foolishness and offensive. Yet, just like the people of Jesus' time and Paul's time also did, Paul tells us that in the first century, Jews demanded signs and Greeks looked for wisdom, but he preached Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. So let's have a look at why the Greeks thought this was foolish. So Greeks were all about wisdom, and for them, this was anything but wise. So Greek philosophy, as best I can tell, it is complicated, taught that there exists a divine principle or plan or truth. They called it logos, that might be familiar to you, that gave order to the cosmos, gave everything form and meaning. This logos served as the foundation for all that is true and good. So it was perfection, and it was completeness, and it was supreme. Plato called it the transcendent divine mind. So the pursuit of wisdom, or the seeking after wisdom, was the pursuit of knowing this divine logos so that one could live out what was true and good. The idea was that if one knew right, one would do right. So there was a huge emphasis on knowledge and education, on the intellect and on rational thinking, because this is how one accessed the divine, the truth, the logos. So when the message of the cross found its way to the ears of the Greeks, a gospel proclaiming that Jesus was the logos, the divine revelation and plan, it's safe to say that a crucified Jew in the backwaters of the Roman Empire didn't fit the bill. A virgin birth, they could believe. Like, it wasn't unusual for their gods to lay with humans. A resurrected man, maybe not too strange for them either. But an insignificant Jew being the exact representation of this transcendent divine mind, whose end was to hang from a tree, dying by crucifixion, which stamped him as dishonourable and corrupt, about as far away as you can get from true and good. Well, that was just utter foolishness. The Greeks sought wisdom, and the message of a crucified Christ, or logos, was anything but wise. The Jews struggled to believe because they looked for signs, and they considered that Christ on a cross was a stumbling block. So the idea of a stumbling block first comes from Leviticus 19. In verse 14 it says, "Do not curse the blind or put a stumbling block in front of the blind." Sorry, "Do not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God, I am the Lord." So don't put something in a blind person's path that would cause them to trip over and fall, which seems pretty straightforward, almost like, did you need to say that? But the Jews, they took this command to have a deeper meaning. They determined that the word blind metaphorically represents any person who is unaware, or any group that might be unsuspecting or ignorant or morally blind. So, and any individual who would take advantage of them or tempt them to do wrong was guilty of breaking this law about stumbling blocks. So you couldn't give bad advice to people that might cause them to do the wrong thing. You couldn't aid and abet someone in breaking God's law. Actually, it's a law that still very much impacts our ethics today. It's wrong to assist or encourage someone to commit a crime, even if you're not the one who is carrying it out. So there's nothing wrong with driving a car unless you're driving a car with the person in the passenger seat to the bank for them to rob it. But it can get confusing. Like, what if you didn't know that that person was going to the bank to do that? Or what about staying silent if you know that someone is intending to or is doing something wrong? You know, can you be guilty of silence? So because this was serious business and had the potential to be confusing, the Jewish people applied a principle called two sides of the river to help people know if they were in danger of becoming a stumbling block. Imagine there was a river, and on your side, you had food that was forbidden for the person on the other side of the river to eat. So if you handed them that food, or if you threw them the food, or if you gave them a boat to cross the river, or if you supplied the wood that would be used to build a bridge, then you were guilty of becoming a stumbling block. You were guilty of breaking the law. It was wrong to cause someone to stumble. It was wrong to take advantage of the weak and the helpless, or to place temptation in the way of people who were morally blind or weak. And according to the Jews, the message of the cross did exactly that. Jesus and any of his followers who suggested that a crucified Christ was sufficient for holiness and salvation and righteousness was guilty of leading people astray. In the eyes of the Jews, the message of the cross caused people to sin. It takes advantage of the spiritually blind and the morally weak. So what is it that we're actually claiming or believing when we preach Christ crucified? Charles Spurgeon writes, so we're saying that Jesus, who is well documented, is the Son of God, but he's both fully God and fully human. So Charles Spurgeon, the quote, not a man made into a God, nor God degraded to the level of a man, not something in between, but he's the absolute God of heaven and earth, the triune God himself, and bone of our bone, flesh of our flesh, as truly God as he was man, or as truly man as he was God. We're saying that this Jesus, who is the cross, this God-man, died to rescue us. The message of the cross is that we are all incredibly, wonderfully created, but we're also broken. This brokenness, it affects every part of who we are and what we do. It affects how we think and the choices that we make, how we act, how we love, how we understand the world around us. This brokenness is such a natural, normal part of the human existence that we struggle to recognize it. And in fact, many people learn to just embrace it and have very little desire to be rid of it. But it stops us from living the life for which we were made. So Jesus came to alert us to our brokenness and make a way for us to enter into this life that we were created for. But it required an exchange. His death for our death. His broken body for our brokenness. Kind of like two sides of the river, where you have on Jesus' side, him holding righteousness and peace and joy and acceptance and wisdom and all that is good, and us on the other side, broken and condemned and sick and dying and ignorant and blind and helpless. But Jesus didn't just stand on his side and throw us some stuff over. He didn't kind of pop us in a boat and pull us towards himself. He actually exchanged places with us. We received the fullness of his side and he the fullness of ours when he died on the cross. A crucified Christ is God's divine plan to save us. The message of the cross is that there is a God who loves us and went to extraordinary lengths to rescue us, to give us life. And while some of us think that is the best news ever, worth giving our lives for, some continue to see the message as foolishness and offensive, a stumbling block to achieving something better in life. The idea of a divine being, a virgin birth, a resurrection, that people are broken and in need of rescuing, that sacrifice and blood was the solution, all of these continue to be seen as either foolish or really offensive to a whole lot of people. And so it shouldn't surprise us when we follow God that at times we'll look pretty foolish to those around us, whether it's family or friends or people who hardly know us. I was speaking with a lady a while ago who was dealing with unfaithfulness in her marriage, and she said to me, "I think God is telling me that I need to stay with my husband, but I think everyone's going to think I'm a fool." And I said to her, "You know what? Some people may. In fact, it probably shouldn't surprise you if they do, because if the message of the cross is foolishness, then living the way of the cross is going to be seen as foolishness. It kind of just comes with the territory." Thankfully, she was encouraged by that, because that probably could have gone either way. About 20 years ago, my husband Scott and I, we were sitting at our kitchen table with a guy from the bank discussing how we might get a loan for our first house. And so we had to show him our budget, and he looked at the line marked tithes and he asked what that was all about. And we explained that we give 10% of our income to the church. And you could see he couldn't quite comprehend why on earth we would want to do that. And he said, "Is that negotiable?" And we said, "No." And it turns out that 90% of our income couldn't secure us a loan to buy a house, and we continued to rent. Now, did that guy walk away going, "They're strange," or maybe even brainwashed? Possibly, but should it surprise us? Not really. Will following God at times make us look foolish? Yeah, it will. Am I aware that what I believe offends people? Acutely aware. Do I wish that the gospel didn't offend? Yep. Do I wish that people who were perishing didn't find it so foolish? Every day. But Paul goes on to say, this foolish plan of God is wiser than the wisest of human plans. And God's weakness is stronger than the greatest of human strength. Remember, dear brothers and sisters, that few of you were wise in the world's eyes or powerful or wealthy when God called you. Instead, God chose things the world considers foolish in order to shame those who think they are wise. And he chooses things that are powerless to shame those who are powerful. God chose things despised by the world, things counted as nothing at all, and used them to bring to nothing what the world considers important. And as a result, no one can ever boast in the presence of God. We can trust that this divine plan that has a cross at its center is far from foolish. But if it's foolish to some in and of itself, how can we, when we speak it and we live it out, not add our own foolishness to the mix? It's one thing for Jesus to be a stumbling block, but how do we make sure that we're not creating unnecessary obstacles to people coming to faith, for people believing the message? Because that's what it's all about at the end of the day, right? We're winning souls. We're wanting people to believe. So as Justin alluded to earlier, I've come up with a 3-step guide to not being stupid. You might find helpful. Step 1, be humble. Paul says in this passage that we're looking at today in verse 30 and 31, it's because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, that is, our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. If we're wise, if there is anything good about our lives, if we're ever tempted to puff ourselves up because of this knowledge that we have, remember, it has nothing to do with what you and I did to get it. We didn't make ourselves right with God. Jesus did. It's not our good behavior or our right thinking that earns us the title of pure and holy. It was Jesus who earned that. We didn't free ourselves from our own brokenness. It's all Jesus. So the moment that we start thinking that somehow being Christian or having access to God's wisdom makes us better than anyone else, we're starting to get it wrong. We're starting to become an obstacle. The message of the cross is true and compelling. I am absolutely convinced of it. But it will always be unattractive and unappealing if the one who is sharing it is arrogant or full of self-righteousness. We put obstacles in the way of people coming to God when we fail to be humble. So, step one, be humble. Step two, be curious. Get to know those who think differently to you. Because if you want to look foolish, then never consider that there could be a viewpoint that is different to your own. It's the best way to appear ignorant, uncaring, and disrespectful. Being curious is also a really great way to help you to stay humble. Because I don't know about you, but I find it really hard to think that I'm better than someone else once I've heard their story. Because it's a whole lot easier, isn't it, to lob grenades across the internet or make sweeping judgments when you've never actually got up close and personal with the people who think differently to you. So being curious by putting ourselves in someone else's shoes and trying to understand their viewpoint, it opens doors to conversations. And I would suggest it opens hearts and minds. It helps people to feel respected and to build respect towards ourselves. Be curious about the what ifs. What if Jesus wasn't born a virgin? What if the world wasn't created in six literal days? What if the disciples faked the resurrection? What if there's no hell? What are the consequences if these aren't true? What if people struggle to believe that Jesus is God, what if he was just a man? What if we just watered down the gospel so that it made it easier for people to stomach? How do the answers to these questions impact the message of the cross? By asking ourselves the what ifs, not only do I think we'll find that it will strengthen our faith as we realize that the message can actually stand up to this questioning, but as we know, there's a whole bunch of people in this world who are asking those questions. Did Jesus really live and die? Is Christianity really true? And it's not just an intellectual exercise for them. It's a matter of life and death for so many. And I think we're going to be a whole lot more effective if we can come alongside those people who are asking those questions and have something more helpful to say than, I don't know, I just believe it. What if we were able to say, you know what, I've given this stuff some thought too, and when I've weighed it all up, this is where I land. Being confident of our own salvation will help others on the path towards theirs. Because remember, this is not about winning arguments. It's about winning souls. Last step, step three. So step one, be humble. Step two, be curious. And step three, be clear. It is so easy to get distracted by issues that are not central to the message of the cross. Even if we're really, really good at arguing our point, know our theology inside and out, can present a really intelligent, scientifically based case for all the things that we believe, but get the basics wrong, we can end up doing more harm than good. Christianity, theology, church life, all these things can quickly get really complex. And I found a fascinating study about what happens when situations are complex. These studies find that it's actually really easy to start forgetting the basics. So, for example, in World War II, the deaths of American pilots upon takeoff and landing were halved when they were reminded of the basic procedures of takeoff and landing. So these men knew how to fly planes in war zones, and yet too often they forgot the basics, which led to their deaths. At Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, qualified doctors who have done a whole lot of study were given a list of 5 bullet points reminding them of basic hygiene, and the result was that infection rates dropped from 11% to 0. Wash your hands, wear a mask, clean the patient's skin. All of these things that were possibly learned on day one, but were forgotten as they continued to learn way more complex things afterwards. What did you learn on day one of coming to know Jesus that maybe you've forgotten? Have you or have we made the gospel more complex than it needs to be and created unnecessary obstacles for people coming to faith? I am going to finish up soon, but before I do that, last week we were blessed with some really awesome testimonies, and I want us to have a listen to our friend Justin Marshall and his experience of coming to know this message of the cross.
My story goes back young, having lived in the church, having served at the altar as an altar boy in a Catholic church back in 61, in the days when it was still Latin, so we had to learn Latin. The prayers were in Latin. And when I was a teenager, I was frustrated, and I left that whole church scene, became an agnostic, came back from my tertiary studies, and back in 78, I was invited to this house church. So this man was invited to come to this on a speaking arrangement back in Malaysia, and I was invited by the pastor to come and listen to him. I was sitting outside near the veranda, and the car pulled up, and this man sort of got out of the car, and something hit me. Something really deep spoke to me to say that man who had just come out has got something that I was looking for. And I, mind you, I did not know what I was looking for. And he was such a fiery preacher. I remember the turmoil in my heart when I heard him speak. They just put an open invitation saying, "Who wants to receive the Lord?" And my hand shot up. Unknown to me, the group was praying for me. And I put my hand up, and something happened to me. Something came into me, starting from my head and right down to my toes. And something happened to my mind. You know, it got a refreshing outlook, refreshing view. It was hard to explain at that time. But I knew later, in years down the track, that was actually being birthed into the kingdom, birthed into the church of God. I got work in Singapore and got introduced to another house church, 4 of us, for at least for 6-7 years. And my foundation and everything came out of that little group. I met my wife in Singapore. We got married in 88. And then we came to Australia. And then in 88, we, for the first time, got into a Baptist church. This was in Norlane in Geelong. as we see God work in so many lives, as we submit and surrender our lives, we'll see that same deliverance that God speaks of in the gospel. Praise God for that. That we are being saved is a present continuous sense. That's a lovely thing, and that's the great expectation that I have and that all of us have as we gather as a church.
How good are these stories? I love them. Hopefully we'll have a few more over the coming weeks. Central to the message of the cross is that there is a God who loves us all, who went to extraordinary lengths to rescue us, to give us life, that life that Justin talks about. What does he want us to do with that? Just love people like he loved us. There's enough offense and foolishness in just that, that we don't need to go adding any more of our own. Christianity, it can seem really complicated at times, difficult to understand. But at the heart of it, we are really just a group of people coming around this idea that there is a God who loves us and went to great lengths to rescue us. A group of people who are on mission to love like him. A group of people who have this audacious, crazy belief that if we can just get this loving one another thing right, we can change the world. Is that foolishness? Maybe. And whilst there are, no one sets out to achieve something extraordinary, try something new, or believe something strange, hoping they'll look stupid, there are people who are willing to look like fools, to believe something strange, to try something new, to achieve something extraordinary. And I really, really hope that you consider yourself counted among this so-called group of fools that you sit with today. The more the merrier, we reckon. But if you don't, I would love to talk to you after the service. Come and see me. Or if you're still just trying to figure out what it's all about, don't forget, we have Alpha starting next Sunday as well. You can come and ask the questions, the what ifs. It's all open. We can talk about whatever.